people are saying out there. It's amazing. We tore it up. We nailed it, man.
Welcome back, everyone, to another, yet another episode of the Working Title Podcast. I'm here with my wonderful, beautiful. Where's he at?
I'm right here.
There I am. Don't get lost, little baby bird.
I'll try.
Now we're back. It's Our Wars. It's Mike from Mike Reports, but it's not just us today. We've got a special guest. We got somebody we're bringing in, Günther Fehlinger. Günther, why don't you tell us a little bit? I think the only one that can truly tell us who you are is you.
Thanks a lot for the invitation. My name is Günther Fehlinger from Austria. I'm an Austrian economist, and I'm also a development consultant. And I lived and worked in Ukraine, Kosovo, and in Albania, Montenegro, Macedonia. And I'm expert for the transformation economy, economic reform in the countries in the post-Soviet and post-Yugoslavian area, and also for EU and NATO integration. And my answer to the Russian war, obviously, now my field on the social media, very active on Twitter, trying to promote victory of Ukraine, liberation of Ukraine, and also then the reintegration of Ukraine into the European Union in NATO, following on the success models of Croatia, of Kosovo, of Montenegro. And this is my base, basically. We can also talk about economics if you want, what's necessary for the reconstruction and integration of Ukraine. But mostly, I think the most important ways is, besides winning the war militarily, it's also to win the war institutionally. And that's what I want to do with my social media performance and with my public appearance. And also, thanks for this invitation to make the case for Ukraine's NATO and EU integration, but also for the Western Balkans, NATO and EU integration, for a strong unity between the US and the EU, and obviously also for a successful 2024, which hopefully will see the liberation of Ukraine and our victory.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, by all means. So again, yeah, thank you for coming on. It's a pleasure and honor to have you. We talked a little bit.
Thank you.
I think you and I first met, I think it was 2021, and we talked a little bit about EU integration. Obviously a lot has changed, you know, being here in Georgia, kind of the fringe element almost, you know, if you're based in Brussels or if you're listening in the US or if you're listening in France, Georgia is sort of the fringe element of the EU, and a lot has changed since 2021. But I guess the best way to launch into it is, where do you see, I mean, obviously, let's zero in on Ukraine, because that's kind of the easy low-hanging fruit for right now, is what do you see, I mean, what is the future for EU and NATO with Ukraine? Because the way I think, you know, Our Wars and I have kind of talked about it is, things have stagnated to a point where, unless there's some magical or big technological change on the battlefield, we're looking at World War One, but with drones and automatic weapons and tanks, of course. But what has to change, and where? How can you get Ukraine integrated when they're in the middle of fighting a trench warfare campaign? I mean, how does that work out, and what do you see?
First of all, we have to make an agreement that we have to assess that on political aspects, the integration of Ukraine in the European Union is a major success already. It was something I was fighting for many years in Ukraine to get this candidate status, and it was utterly impossible to achieve it. And now we have achieved the candidate status and the start of the negotiations even. So this is a tremendous progress in terms of European future of Ukraine. And you will see Ukraine will do very well. And they are doing, even despite the war, tremendous reforms in Kiev and in the regions, and also the preparations and integration and the political consensus for Ukraine as a EU member is absolutely now there. And we will definitely do that. And that's a major step. The next big thing is obviously then the NATO membership promise, because we are in this situation since 2008, yeah, when we did a kind of loose kind of yes, but no. And then in reality, we have invited the aggression of Russia by Russia in 2008 in Georgia and in 2014 and then in 2022, because we were not firm on the NATO membership. And what's now still missing is a clear yes to Ukraine in NATO. And that must happen now at the beginning of 2024. And this is the way to win the war. because once Russia understands that Ukraine will anyhow be in NATO, no matter what the military outcome is, then the incentives to fight for Ukraine's not being in NATO is, of course, much lower because they have lost that war militarily. Basically, they have lost it already, but then they lost it also politically. And we have to make this promise very clear, very loud, and we have to post it out on the social media channels that everybody in Russia understands very clearly Ukraine is ours, it's in NATO, and it will be in the EU. And that's why I'm also campaigning for the euro as the most visible sign for Ukraine, because all these three, they are basically a unit, NATO, EU, and the euro. So this is what we have to do to win the war. Make it very clear that Ukraine will be in NATO, and that must be very clear commitment from the European Union members, from the NATO allies, from basically everybody. And this must be communicated very clearly to Russia. And then basically they have also lost politically. And of course, we need to win the war militarily as well. And it's actually not so complicated. I know there's a lot of the military experts out there. They are starting to discuss the numbers of ammunition and, you know, the stalemate and the World War One scenario. It's, in my view, a complete misapprehension of what is happening on the battlefield. What we still need to do, and Ukraine is very careful with its human resources and with its soldiers, and that's very good for a democracy. We need to give more military technology to Ukraine. And then they will be in the spring absolutely able to liberate Crimea and this part between Crimea and the Dnipro River. Of course, you know, it's more difficult in the eastern Donbass, which is already occupied since 2014. It's more complicated area because there's more logistical connection towards Russia. But the Crimea and the Kherson, the eastern Kherson region and the southern region is absolutely possible to liberate in the coming months. And this will be also decisive for the end of the Putin regime, because that's what this war is about. And then he has lost militarily and politically. And this will be absolutely unavoidable, to be very clear towards the Russian public as well. So his rule of Russia will also be ended in the year 2024. I'm very confident on that outcome.
Gunther, do you think you see, when you're like looking at like obstacles in Ukraine's path to NATO membership, do you think you see more obstacles within the NATO and like NATO states who are reluctant to have Ukraine join, or more obstacles in Ukraine itself with reluctance to join?
No, in Ukraine, there is no reluctance, and there is also absolutely the capacity to join NATO, and they fulfill the standards needed for that, and they fulfill also politically, there is a clear yes. So, and also what is always this Russian propaganda against Ukraine, and that's very corrupt country. It's not more or less corrupt country than Bulgaria, Romania, or Croatia, or many other countries which we take in the beginning. And of course, the joint membership of NATO and of EU and the process towards it is already then transforming countries into much cleaner and less corrupt economies and states. And that's the way to do it. And it works very well. We are not at the beginning of the transformation of Eastern Europe. People like me are doing that now. I do it since 20 years. But there's people like us and the process. We have integrated 13 countries into the European Union in the last 25 years. And we know exactly what we're doing, and we are reforming the other countries. And Ukraine is actually a kind of a master child in terms, a master student of reform, because the way they digitalize the public administration and the reform, really every aspect of the society and of the regulation is very, very exemplary for how to do it. So this will be no problem. The problem is more inside, as we always have it in Germany, in France, but also in the US. We have this appeasement camp. We have this camp of anti-Ukrainian forces, partly because they are paid by Russia, they are funded by Russian interest, or basically they have some kind of mystified perception of the role of Russia in the world for whatever left-wing or right-wing extremist ideas. Yeah, this is, you know, there's many of these reasons for that. But that's the problem. We have to win this war institutionally inside our own political systems. That's what I try to do. We have to convince our population that only a secure Ukraine is really like a shield towards the Russian aggression. And the war ultimately can only end with NATO membership, because ultimately this is what this war is about. And so let's have Ukraine in NATO. Let's win this war that way, militarily and institutionally. And then the war will be over and we will have peace in Europe, because nobody will attack a NATO country, certainly not Russia, because as you see, they are not even able to win the war against Ukraine with our very small support, which we are giving. Or gradually it's getting better. But now, gradually, I think the most Western systems and politicians understood that we have to significantly support Ukraine. And that's the consensus in Brussels and Washington. And the supplies will come. Financially, militarily, you will see also the German Taurus will come. There will be more of these attackers. And that will be decisive for the breakthrough. And it will change the battlefield very much in favor of Ukraine. And also the F-16s will come. So all these things will come now in the coming weeks and months. And it will lead to the fact that Ukraine will have the resources and the tools for victory. And Russia is already in free collapse. The winter is very harsh in Russia. The political consensus and system is breaking. And you will see that the Russian economy is also very hard hit by our sanctions, by the effect of this general costs of the war and many other factors, and 2024 will see the decisive victory of Ukraine.
And so when it comes to pushback within NATO from, you know, against Ukraine joining, I haven't stayed up to date on a long time, but is there still conflict when you have countries like Turkey who are, you know, at least before were not as along with the program, or at least they wanted benefits to themselves to go along with allowing Ukraine into NATO?
You know, every country will have some certain conditions. And, you know, the Turks are very famously also always conditioning every consent with something for, what is in for them. For them, the question of Finnish and or Swedish NATO accession, where we have the example where they have been blocking, and Finland, they have consented already, and Sweden, the committee in the parliament has agreed already, so they will ultimately say yes as well. But they also want something then from the US, some airplanes, technology, support. So it's a bit of a transactional relation we have with Turkey. But I want to defend Turkey a little bit. It's a very pivotal country for us. It's a very important country at the front line to Iran and to Russia. It's a very difficult situation they have. But okay. It will be complicated, but they are very much on the Ukrainian side. Their Bayraktars, their drones, have been decisive in the first days of the war to block the Russian advance towards Kiev. And nobody in Ukraine has forgotten that. They are absolutely very friendly with Ukraine, and they definitely want Crimea to be back in Ukraine, because that's basically for them much better than a Russian Crimea. And also there's the Crimean Tatars, which are prosecuted by the Russians now. And the Crimean Tatars are basically very close to the Turkish. And so it's a lot of links. And I would actually think that Turkey will be a big supporter of Ukraine's NATO integration the moment America, which is the ultimate decision maker, will have a clear yes. And I'm not sure that Biden is really saying it before the election. But if Nikki Haley will be elected, she will absolutely do it. And I think there will be enormous pressure on Biden in the spring of 2024 to settle this war. And the only way the war can stop is NATO membership of Ukraine. And so and then he will also get the consensus with the Turks and with others who might be reluctant to achieve that, because ultimately he wants to win his second term. And going with an open war into the second term will be very complicated for Mr. Biden. So if he wants to win, he better win the war in Ukraine. And for this, he needs to put Ukraine into NATO.
It's interesting how a strategic role Turkey plays in the region. And for so long, too. I mean, really going throughout the entire Cold War, they were very much this decisive power. And of course, there was the conflict over, you know, in the at various points in the Cold War over, you know, NATO versus, a USSR deployment around those areas and sort of, you know, people, you know, you got a bigger missile, I get a bigger missile, that sort of back and forth. And I think it's interesting you bring up sort of Biden and other presidential candidates' positions on it, because I think that's going to be, depending on how the war goes, that could very much affect the next election in the United States, because, you know, people might be more inclined to support a candidate that they think will get the conflict resolved either one way or the other. I'm looking at a recent Gallup poll back in November, you know, it's a couple months old, but where 41% of Americans said the U.S. is doing too much to support Ukraine, and 64% of Americans said that neither side is winning. So I think that will definitely be like probably one of our hot topic issues going into this next election, is how people think the conflict is going, and then you know, where they decide to throw their weight behind. Because, you know, while the American contribution to Ukraine in terms of our military overall budget is not very big, it's definitely, I can say, is like someone, you know, like politically here, it's a big, you know, hot topic issue of people sort of, you know, very much sort of in the mindset of that their, you know, their tax money is being sent to somewhere that they don't know, you know, or somewhere that they've never been or never heard about really much. You know, in reality, it's like less than a couple percentiles of our entire military budget. And
you're sending damn tax dollars to the Ukraine for rockets and bombs for doing what now? And I think that's exactly and I have friends that is their perspective. I had to
it's an interesting, you know, conversation, because there is a lot of money, you know, arguably, you know, people, you could argue in a position that, oh, you know, maybe that there's, you know, for specifically an American citizen in some town, they're, you know, they would want to see money applied elsewhere. But I'm of the belief that it's the U.S. military, and that money was never going to end up going back to American taxpayers regardless. It was just going to be spent on some other U.S. military project. But now it's being diverted to Ukraine. Like, I think I can look it up while you continue. But yeah, it's just what are your thoughts on that sort of part of it?
Really quick, on that note, I pulled it up. So of the U.S. federal budget, just to give our listeners an idea, 0.7, so not a full, not even a full percent, 0.7% of towards foreign aid comprises of a significant portion of all foreign aid. And that's not like even the whole thing. So when we talk about going to Ukraine, I don't have the number right now. Our wars, if you can find it, but I think it's even a fraction of, so you have a fraction of a fraction of a percent of the, of these billions that are trillions that are going out the door going to Ukraine, just for people that, that might be at odds with that. So
I'm a lifelong taxpayer's representative, and I always say, you know, let's be very careful with the tax money. But, you know, it's a question. And we are in a 100 years debate about American involvement in European wars, yeah, from the First World War to the Second World War to the Cold War to the Balkan Wars to the Ukraine War. But it's always a question how you phrase the question. If you ask the American public, do you fancy losing towards Russia in Europe? Or do you fancy a Russian Europe? Or do you fancy to lose? I'm sure many Americans will not fancy to lose. Yeah? Of course, you know, many might not really know exactly what the war in Ukraine is about. But it's one of these many wars in Europe, which we have, unfortunately, because we are here at the front line with the hostile Russia. And this is the situation. And it's a question of democracy, and it's a question of autocracy. And America has been intervening on that side of democracy, of European democracy, in exactly the First World War, the Second World War, the Cold War, the Balkan War, and of course the Ukraine War. It's now 5 wars in a century. And you can of course say why we Europe don't get our act together and are peaceful and nice, yeah? I say, tell it to the Russians and or the Serbs for that respect, in that, or the Germans before. You know, it's unfortunate, but it's necessary. And the cost of military intervention in a full-scale European war is, of course, hugely uncomparable, more expensive to now this small-scale support which Ukraine needs to get in order to win. Because in a real full-scale confrontation, like a new Cold War, with full military mobilization, with a full nuclear arsenal and all the additional costs, yeah, that will be really very expensive. And so it's much better to win now fast. And then basically the Russian regime will crumble because their big gamble of a victory in Ukraine has been lost. And so it's a good investment. It pays really off. And also it's simply the right thing to do. And America ultimately is built as a nation signing city on the hill to defend freedom in the whole world. Ultimately, this is the thing. This is the story. And, you know, losing in Ukraine is certainly nobody's option. And but some few on the right of the MAGA Republicans who are basically also on the Russian payroll. Because look, from Rohrabacher to the Trump links in the campaign in 16 and 20, they were all very closely connected to Russian operatives. And this is the fact. And it's all, of course, to undermine the armament support, the weapon supplies for Ukraine in order to win that war which Putin is waging, I remind, since 2014. And because some of you are in Georgia, actually we are in the status of war with Russia since 2008. And it's correct. About time to win it.
So I want to latch on to something just really quick that you mentioned about the economics, and especially the defense economics of Europe. And sure, the defense economics of the U.S. do come into play. Of course they do. They have to. But the defense economics, I hear a lot of Europeans that kind of sing the same song as we hear in the U.S., where it's like, oh, why is this? This isn't our war. This isn't our thing. Let the Ukrainians defend their soil. We in France, Portugal, Germany, etc. We in these sectors, we don't. Why do we have to take advantage of this? Why are we involved in this? We in Amsterdam, we're not fighting Russians. We're eating our lunch. We're going to business meetings. Why do we have to deal with this? And why are we spending so much money after we've given tanks, rockets, ammunition? Why do we have to give this? I think the common thing is I heard one complaint. I don't remember the source, but it was something about the Bundeswehr, the German military, about their complete incapability of fighting war. And they said, well, we're giving all of our equipment, our money, a lot of our defense fund, or potentially money in the defense fund, going to Ukraine when that should be going back into the Bundeswehr. And sort of the argument, and I want to kind of hear your rebuttal on, well, because I think I know what it is. I personally would say, well, instead of fighting Russia with money, with men, you're fighting it with dollars, but I think, or euros, correctly. But what is sort of like the response? Because I guess there's a little bit of thing, if you're a citizen of Berlin or München or something, Munich, to say, why am I all the taxes I'm paying going to this when this has nothing to do with my daily life?
Yes, you know, ultimately it's the Ukrainians are fighting and dying for their defense. Yeah, there's no German citizens or Portuguese citizens dying. Some of them might be voluntarily going. We are paying indirect the cost, and this is the responsibility of Mr. Putin because he started the war. It was not our aggression. We have not attacked anybody. The whole effort of the last 20 years of Putin's power, 24 years, is to appease him, to buy off his energy, and not to have aggressive posture against Russia. We have really unarmed Europe, and we have bought so much Russian energy just in the hope that the whole strategy was, yeah, not that we have exactly what we have now, this war. You know, that was the whole effort of Nord Stream 2, of all this gas purchases, of all this disarmament, not to be aggressive towards Russia, that Putin has no reason to attack. Yeah? This was the whole 20 years, yeah. And it has failed. It has failed completely because Putin has decided to settle things militarily. Now, by the way, we need to settle it militarily because he started it militarily and there is not an easy political solution. We must really win this war. That is, of course, unfortunately for the Portuguese citizens or for the Amsterdam citizen that they have been to pay indirectly via high energy prices and their taxes also for the victory. Yeah, you know, that's the price of freedom ultimately and the security they enjoy because they are in NATO and the European Union. And of course, less fortunate countries and people like Ukraine is not inside. So if we had taken the risk and taken Ukraine into NATO before, we wouldn't have this war at all. And the whole costs of life and money would not be there at the moment. Yeah? And that's the weakness of the West has led to this war very much as the Russian aggression. And so we are also guilty, indirectly blame generations of European politicians and American officers for this war, because when we somehow disarm all the time, then ultimately our enemies feel they have a heyday, and then they think they can do exactly these wars. And the world is in disarray at the moment exactly because of this weakness, especially of America. And now back to America. America needs to be strong and needs to be armed and needs to be in an ability to deter the rest of the world to aggress on their neighbors. Yeah? This is only the American nation which has the possibility economically, militarily, and also the will to fight. Yeah? Because this is all we don't have in Europe. And this is unfortunately, you can be angry with us, it's okay. You know, I'm also angry with us, yeah, it's, but it doesn't change. We don't have, since the World War II, this will to fight anymore. And by the way, given that we made some terrible crimes in World War II, especially the Germans and Austrians, it's also a certain understanding, you know, who really wants German aircraft carriers on the world seas? Who wants German nuclear weapons? Who wants German soldiers in Ukraine? You know, this is all historically boo, boo, boo. You know, it's unfortunate. What we really do at the moment, by the way, Germany, and contrary to Austria, where I come from, but we have not delivered anything in Austria to our great shame, but Germany is the number one after America, the number one in Europe of weapons supplier provider to Ukraine. So there is really some really big change in policy. And also financially, we seriously participate in the costs of the war in Ukraine. We are paying up. It's absolute propaganda that we don't pay. We pay about half the costs of Ukraine as EU and EU member states. Yeah? And also we have made this huge commitment, I repeat, of integrating Ukraine in our political community. This is about as huge as America has integrated Texas in the Union in the 1850s, or I don't know exactly when, but after this Mexican War, you took Texas, and Ukraine is quite the Texas. It was also a very big investment to take that in, and it is also very expensive. It will cost us about $100 billion every single year in the future to bring Ukraine to European Union living and welfare standards. We will do that. And so it's not true that we are somehow on the sidelines of it, or we don't care, or we are somehow free riders. We are free riders on the military, it's true, but it's also, and that we have to concede as well, this world power status which the United States has, it comes also with advantages in the world, also financial advantages. And you are again on the top of the world in economic terms. You are again on the top of the world in share of GDP of the world. Yeah, you're a very successful nation, even when the perception you have internally of a crisis, which is for me always a mystery, but the rest of the world envies your success. Most of the people in the world want to move to America. You are a little bit reluctant to let everybody in. But it's also a sign of success that basically it's the best and freest and most successful and most prosperous nation of the world. And it comes also with some costs that you have to be able to defend and the freedom and the status quo of the world. And this is also something you know, that's part of the deal. If you want to lead the world, you have also costs in this leadership, but the benefits outweigh the costs massively. And this is the story of this 20th century, 21st century. And let's better have it again in the 20th century for many, many decades to come, because the alternative of a Russian-Chinese world is really very terrible. And ask your voters and your people, do you want to live in a Russian-Chinese world order? And I'm sure nobody really opts for that, and nobody in his mind can opt for such a terrible vision as we see, a world of torture, a world of disaster and chaos. And this is the offer the Russians and Chinese have for us. And I think nobody wants to do that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, I think a big, you know, you were talking about earlier about sort of the investment side of it and the idea that, you know, putting money and resources in now to helping Ukraine push back against the Russian invasion will, you know, first, you know, like it will, you know, obviously help Ukrainian people not get absolutely decimated and their culture destroyed by Russia, which is, you know, very much this war is based on an idea of cultural destruction, to sort of, you know, to get rid of the idea that Ukraine is a separate country, a culture, a people, apart from Russia and with its own individual history, because that very much goes against sort of Putin's vision and an idea of history. But then also, you know, preventing further Russian military intervention actions in Europe, because I think, you know, if there's one thing that Putin has shown throughout his entire, you know, reign, is that he's not happy with just one area of expansion. You know, he's very much expansion oriented for the, you know, Russian state, or, you know, or and almost a, you know, a very much like a Russian imperial system of taking land that he believes is, you know, what we know or was once Russian controlled, and he believes is still Russian owed. And I've talked about this before, I think on this podcast and also like in my content, but he's very much, you know, a monarchist in many of his beliefs. He you know, believes himself to be emulating Peter the Great, and he believes a lot in that, like, imperial Russian ideas of going back to where the boundaries were a few hundred years ago, of taking back areas like Finland and Poland, Lithuania, you know, and Georgia, Ukraine, you know, and even eastern words as well. And I think a lot of people are under the impression that, oh, if, you know, I think, you know, especially in the West, that if he just, you know, if he let Putin have his way, that he'll just stop and that the conflict won't continue. But, you know, there's very much, there's so much evidence pointing towards, you know, the you know, the most likely reality that after Ukraine, regardless of whether there's success or not, that he will still continue to try to start conflicts elsewhere, because that's all he is able to do to stay in power politically. And that's also like his main goal, and that he's never been very subtle about that either. He's never been like very, you know, like keeping it under wraps that his plan is to militarily and you know, sort of imperially grow Russia to get more resources, whether that's people or land or political gain.
Look, let's be a little bit optimistic here at the beginning of the year and also stay to the facts. Yeah? The situation is that Russia tried to conquer Ukraine. Did it achieve it? No. Is Kiev fallen? No. Is the war basically won on the side of the Ukrainians and the West? Yes. Yeah? You know, there was a huge effort from Russia to go via Belarus, via Kharkiv, via the south, to conquer everything. Yeah? And they have now 17% of the country, and they had, I think, 8% before. So they have doubled their part and their share of occupied territory. And they have basically lost most, if not basically, I don't know the percentage, of the country they had in the beginning of the war in March. There, it was very close. Yeah? It was very close. And the decisive intervention of American support, preparation of American support, British support, Turkish support, yeah, and also the Ukrainian will to fight, has really won this war. And we are somehow now, because we have not pushed back the last 8% or the last 16%, we are somehow in this kind of, oh, we should actually win. And I also think that we should win. Yeah, we should actually win. Yeah, it's completely lack of understanding and lack of patience on my side that we don't win. It's Jack Sullivan. Yeah, Jack Sullivan and his appeasers who don't give the means. Yeah. Why didn't we give the F-16s already 1 year ago? Why didn't we give this Atacmas and all these rockets and the cruise missiles? Yeah, would we have won the Yugoslavian war if we wouldn't have bombed the bridges in Belgrade in 99? Would we have won the Bosnian war if we didn't bomb very hard the Bosnian Serbs? Yeah? And what's this kind of restrained warfare idea? Yeah? Just because anybody thinks Medvedev goes nuclear, you know, it's not happening, the nuclear war. Nobody is attacking Russia here. Yeah? And actually, now, by the way, Ukraine is attacking Russia regularly, and still there is no nuclear war. So we are not talking about the nuclear scenario, because everybody, of course, that is, needs to be avoided. Yeah? But this kind of fighting with both hands back, yeah, which we are doing since 1 year, when it's basically just to remove Russia out of the last remaining territory it is still keeping. And, you know, also one argument. Who in the history, when in the history, has ever a country which has attacked another country and is then in the defensive, which Russia is in the defensive war? They are very good in this defensive war, respect for that, yeah? But they are in a defensive situation. And who has won a war in that situation? And they are completely now defending in occupied and in hostile territory. And certainly they will, of course, you know, maybe it takes a bit longer than I provision that until they have finally kicked out. But they will be kicked out because the population is against them, because the supply lines are, of course, disastrous, and because technology, they are very, very far behind. And of course, fiscally, economically, they are just a shadow of the Soviet Union, which was a serious enemy. And Russia today is just a shadow of the past. And we are really very strong. And we will gradually, obviously, mobilize. And all this kind of resistance against serious help, which we have overcome in Germany and in the US. And, you know, it always takes with gradual packages, serious, you know, no fighter planes, then suddenly fighter planes, no tanks, and then tanks, and no rockets, and suddenly rockets. I really don't know what we are doing here, like a complete loser strategy. And we definitely have to get going, and we will win this war. And, you know, there's no need for defeatism or kind of a winter fatigue or like a Ukraine fatigue, yeah? Because we are on the winning stream, and we definitely will win this war.
I have an interesting, I don't know if question is the right, I don't know the right thing, but to call it, but is it something, and this is maybe, so I'll put it this way. So I've got a lot of, like, not a lot, but a handful of my German friends that to this day, they will say there is a difference between parts of Berlin that were, you know, at the time, East and West Berlin. And I haven't been to Berlin, not yet. I think I might go in February, but there you can tell a difference between what used to be East Berlin and what used to be West Berlin. And there are different sentiments, both even today, like politically, people vote differently. People talk, you know, sentiments are different. Do you think even if there is a victory for Ukraine, do you think there is going to be some sort of underlying sentimentality in the currently occupied territory or the Russian held territory that is now that is going to continually undermine Ukrainian sovereignty, even if there was a victory?
Look, you can make the case in America, there are still guys running around with Confederate flags in the year 2023. Yeah? And in this terrible 6th of January, there was a guy running around with a Confederate flag for the Capitol. Yeah? You know, unfortunately, what you see in many of these situations, like also in Eastern Germany, there are some people from an old generation and some fringe left-wing or right-wing groups which have some nostalgia for the past. Yeah? This is happening in history. It's a kind of strange phenomenon, yeah, but it's a little bit unavoidable. But in the terms of Ukraine, yeah, I don't think that before, and I know that very well because I lived and worked in Ukraine and I know the file very well, yeah, the Donbas economic political elite, yeah, in Ukraine, they were very dominant. There was no suppression of Russian Donbass Ukrainians in Ukraine, definitely not under Yanukovych. He was himself one guy of them, and they were running the show. They are very rich and part of the country because of these industrial assets which they have inherited from the Soviet Union. It's full of coal mines, full of steel mines, full of industrial assets. And they really have taken over many parts of Ukraine during their rule, especially of the Yanukovych. And still today, it's not so poor area. So I don't think there will be huge resentments. Some people who have committed crimes, obviously, they will flee to Russia and try to hide because definitely they will be held accountable after liberation. But I don't think there will be some kind of a resentment or a significant political movement of separatism. The moment the Russian occupation forces have left, the people will be more than happy to be part of the NATO EU Ukraine, which will be surely moving into the West. And the living standards in Poland or in Croatia or in other areas of the new Europe, they are so much bigger than in Ukraine already. And I think 10, 15 times bigger than in Donbass today, obviously. And they will be living in freedom, security. There will be no torture chambers, obviously, anymore like today under this illegal Russian occupation system. And the people will be much more happy.
No more torture chambers. How are people going to vote?
Anyhow, exactly. There's a lot of, you know, misunderstanding what it is to live under Russian occupation, because Putin is such a powerful communicator, even in the American right. But the reality, and that's not funny, the reality in occupied Donbass is that in the night they come and take the people out of their apartments into torture chambers. And I want to know if anybody from the American right who loves freedom on his name and really fights for freedom would like a system where the state is coming into your house and takes you into some cellar and tortures you and your wife and your family. I don't think that this is the system you want in America. And that's the reality in the Donbass today.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's another thing that you mentioned early on that I don't know. I'm not a proponent of this point of view. It's just kind of a devil's advocate, but it's something where, like you mentioned, this is not a war against necessarily Russia. This is more war against the Putin regime. Whereas I'm sure you are, and our wars and myself spend probably too much time digging through Russian propaganda, Russian social media. That's not just Telegram. I mean, I'm sure he and I spend hours going through VKontakt, OKRU, like a lot of this stuff to try and find out what's actually going on behind the scenes. And not everyone, because there's still definitely a lot of people that do not are like, this is stupid. This is pointless. Why are we in this war? But there's a lot of people that genuinely believe, there's still a firm base of resistance that says to be at war with Russia is to be at war with Putin. And to be at war with Putin is to be against the Russian people. It's almost like kind of an old czarist ideology, whereas if you are against one, you are against all of us. Is there something where that says, if Europe's going to fight against us in the perspective of a Russian with this ideology, that maybe there is something that says, you know what, we should bring the fight to Europe because maybe they are the aggressor against Russia and the Russian people. And I guess my question would be, what would you say, because I don't believe that, but what would you say to somebody who is saying that and saying, you know, Gunter, why? No, we're not going to do this. This is a fight against against the people of Russia by Europe, against our way of life.
Look, in 1991, we were very lucky that the Soviet Union fell more or less peacefully apart. And since then, and the American policy and the European policy is to be as nice as possible towards Yeltsin at that time. You might remember Yeltsin. Huh? Yeltsin was the guy who was fighting Chechenian independence. These are Russian citizens. Let's say, like Puerto Rico. You don't give the full citizenship to them or the statehood. But let's compare to Florida, let's say. Yeah? These are Russian citizens. In the year 1992-93, they want independence. And Yeltsin has bombed and bombarded them and killed many of them. Yeah? And we said nothing. We said, oh, just, you know, let's be nice because we love Russia. But the Chechenians didn't want to be part of that. And they were killed by the Russian state as Russian citizens on droves. Yeah? And Grozny was completely destroyed. And we said nothing. Second time, Putin started, because the Chechenian won in 1994, we didn't help them and we didn't recognize. Putin came back 5 years later and he bombarded them, destroyed the whole city and slaughtered them en masse. And what we did, we said nothing because we love Russia, because it's so easy to make business with one guy on the top, meaning Yeltsin or Putin. And it's very difficult because we don't really care so much who lives there in this Russian situation, because there are Chechenians, there are Buratians, there are Mongolians, there is Yakutians, and there is hundreds of different people in Russia living, who many of them really wouldn't like to live in Russia, and they don't want to be living under a Russian system. But we have sold them out, because it's so good to make energy business in nuclear, in oil and gas, with one guy on the top who runs everything of this resource-rich conglomerate of a state. And we have basically sold out the Russian people for a very long time because we love to make business with the top guy in the Kremlin. This is the story of our relation with Russia. And it's completely based on appeasement and on business. And it is really selling out the people. Because the people in Russia, they live in poverty and misery. Who really wants to live in Russia? They have so many people have left there. And look at New York. Look at the whole East Coast. Look at whole of America. How many hundreds and thousands, I don't know the exact numbers, millions of Russians are living there because the first moment they ran away because nobody really wants to live there. And now you see, even now in this situation where economically it was a little bit more stabilized, the war, you know, the hundreds and thousands, if not millions of people are running away if they have the money for any alternative and the title to go. Unfortunately, we are very restrictive to let them in. But if it would be a little bit more open towards the Russians, this country would bleed out very soon because it's a terrible economic system to live in. It's for the few top guys who have somehow stolen a metallurgic company or aluminium factory or some big mine or who are very close to the whatever kind of power in the Kremlin. Then you are living fine if you have some billions and big industrial plant, yeah, that you stolen, fine. But the rest of the Russian middle class, no matter if they are from an ethnic or religious or political minority, but even the normal standard people who work in factories and who are some middle managers there, they live in a terrible situation, always afraid of the authorities, always needing to sleazy and greasy somehow the system in order just to have a normal life. And that's a disaster. And you know, who wants that? And that we are somehow at war with the Russian people is totally ridiculous. Yeah. And the reality is true. We sell out the Russian people in order to have business with the top guy and with the elite because we love to sell them some nice villas in Côte d'Azur or in New York State apartment, you know, this kind of fancy $1 million assets. And then we love the Russians if they, but these people are exploiting their own middle classes and their own normal people back there. So give me a break on that argument. In reality, we should really focus on the citizen there and also on the minorities and treat Russia just as a normal other country. They are really misabusing their people and we should stop this kind of complicity with Russian power.
I think, and so much of, you know, there really is this deep sort of just lack of caring for the Russian people from those who lead it. And I mean, you know, that's, you know, I think, you know, people can be nihilistic and say that to about every government and politician, you know, I think if you go far enough, but there really is this sort of idea of that the Russian people are expected to die and sacrifice themselves for the interests of who's ever in power. And that's kind of how it's been this sort of, you know, like national, like link to this idea, I think that stretches what, you know, back to the czarists and before probably of, you know, these ideas of like a feudal society, you know, being, you know, basically plundered as manpower for war. And especially, you know, you're mentioning ethnic minorities. That's something we've seen hugely that Russia has done, where they polled for, you know, the first year of the war primarily, although, you know, definitely recruiting and conscripting in Western Russia, but so much of pulling from the massive ethnic minority populations that live in various you know, republics and regions in the Eastern Russia. And, you know, areas that some of these places don't even have running water or working electricity, yet they're still expected to, you know, be sent halfway across the, you know, the country to Ukraine to go fight in a war that has nothing to do with them. You know, Buryatia was a really big one that we saw pulled from in the beginning. And, you know, even going all the way to, you know, the far reaches of Vladivostok and, you know, Yekaterinburg and that sort of stuff all the way in the east. There's really been this effort of distancing. Well, for, you know, of course, there was a goal of distancing Western Russians from the war by not having to conscript upon them. But of course, that changed, you know, after losses kept piling up and, you know, more soldiers need to be conscripted. But I think it was really interesting how you mentioned about the oligarchs, because I think so many people forget that's like very much how the conflict in Ukraine started in the Donbass. Was you had these oligarchs linked to Russia in the Donbass and Donetsk and Luhansk, and that you know, both were working slightly with some of the separatists, the Russian-backed separatists, but then, you know, very much were you know, quickly sort of taken over by the influence of like larger Russian oligarchs and the Russian state moving in. But, you know, it really all started again from this idea of exploitation, where there were people in the region, you know, much more wealthy and much more affluent than the rest, who decided to use it to try to springboard themselves into a better situation and get more power and political and military sort of weight. But, you know, it really just led to the suffering of the people who lived in those areas. And, you know, of course, now the Donbass is very much, you know, just wrecked from every direction. And it's even if, you know, conflict were to stop immediately, it would take decades and decades to rebuild some of the cities, which have, you know, some of them have been absolutely wiped off the map by the war.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's really terrible. The most striking example, and you know, all insiders know that, yeah, because it was in Mariupol, this famous city, where basically the workers and the leading oligarch there, Akhmetov, they have resisted Putin's takeover attempt in May 2014. And they have armed the workers of that steel company, and they have not allowed Putin to march into that city. That's why the front line came to a standstill some 15 kilometers away, east of Mariupol. And Putin consistently has threatened Mariupol, and it was very clear he will come back. And, you know, he came back, and he destroyed the whole city. And he took very bitter revenge for their reluctance to subdue towards Russian power. The people there didn't want it, and he has destroyed that city. In the March 2022, he has destroyed the whole of the center. I was there in February still on my solidarity visit before the war to warn everybody. And I put it all on social media and said, please, yeah, defend Mariupol. But the West was not ready. And Putin was very clearly taking his revenge. Yeah. You disobeyed me in 14. I came back in 2022. And they put even under the theater kids here, children, deti, it's called in Russian. And the pilots knew that, but they had the order to destroy that central theater with all the refugees inside. And this was a huge war crime. And once Mariupol will be free, we will see the immensity of the Russian war crimes, especially in these occupied regions of the south, where hundreds and thousands of people have been killed by the Russian military machine. And this is a huge war crime. And for this, Putin must be held accountable. And he will, after he will be defeated in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of, I mean, even in areas that have been under Ukrainian control for months and months are still uncovering, like, you know, unmarked graves and war crimes that were reported or that have been discovered through, like, preliminary evidence. When I first, I was visiting Ukraine in July of 2022 to spend some time with American and British volunteers who were training a Ukrainian border guard in TDF. And then I also spent some time volunteering at a local animal shelter there in Kyiv. But we entered Ukraine. Well, originally I was supposed to take a train across, but of course got canceled because of a rocket attack. And so I had to end up taking a bus from Warsaw across the border. And we the route that we ended up going was through Bukha and Irpin. And, you know, in those areas, I mean, not only is, you know, were they, you know, just destroyed from a level of environmental and infrastructural, but, you know, the people, the massacres that happened there are still very much lingering. And, you know, those who committed those crimes are still, you know, either held unaccountable or are lost in the wind. You know, maybe they're dead, maybe they've, you know, died throughout the progress of the war, but there's certainly so much which is, you know, as you said, so many war crimes, which so many will have yet to be held accountable for. And it's interesting to see, I think, how that process will go, because, I mean, you know, this will be one of the first times since, you know, World War II, essentially, where we're going to, there will probably be war crime proceedings on such a level.
Sure.
Where so many, you know, from not just a high, you know, because you've had, you know, there were prosecutions, of course, in Yugoslavia, and in other, you know, wars against war crimes, but to such a level where, you know, going down to command to all these different level, you know, units and soldiers and NCOs, it'll be interesting to see the proceedings that happen with that.
There will be a time of justice. It will come.
Yeah, for sure. I think, and I mean, I guess before we cut out, I know we're getting a little bit, running a little bit late, but I guess the last question, and because of your broad, both economic, geopolitical, and a little bit of military, what is your outlook? What do you see going on? What do you see the future of Europe, the EU, NATO, Ukraine, of course, Georgia as well, you know, me being still here, and Moldova. What does the future actually look like? And I mean, realistically, because it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a brutal fight. We've got elections coming up here in Georgia. We have an ongoing stalemate in Ukraine. Moldova is still fighting its own fight. I know it still has several prominent pro-Russian parties, and of course, it's occupied or Russian-held, I should say, Transnistria. What are we looking at for the rest of 2024? And do we have anything? Do we have a gleam of hope? Or
yes, absolutely. You know, we are very strong. The West is at its strongest, and it's continued to be very strong long term. The economic fundamentals are absolutely in our favor, and they will be very, very much in our favor for the coming decades to come. And what is the logic, the strategic logic? We have to make sure that we are more united in the European Union and in NATO, and we will. The decisive moment was the decision to take Ukraine into the European Union. This will be now prepared. It will take 5, 6, 10 years. We will see exactly how long it will take. But this is really tremendously game-changing situation. And the same decision must be taken for NATO's membership of Ukraine and all the other smaller countries all around, which there are, from whatever, Bosnia, Kosovo, Moldova, Georgia, and all the other countries inside the EU, inside NATO. And also the EU must be more united in terms of common debt instruments, which we have now in the Ukraine war and in COVID, very successfully deployed, in common military rearmament. We need a kind of Pentagon-style military procurement, which we are now getting, actually. We will put another $100 billion into the war defense effort in our industrial capacity. This is very, very strong. And also, I'm arguing for the EU to join NATO immediately as a political union. And so more unity on our side. This is very clear. A free trade agreement with America and the European Union as the crowning achievement of the next presidency and the next EU mandate between 24 and 29. This needs to be done. And also outreach efforts via the OECD to the rest of the world. Please.
So you mentioned a joint of NATO, which is, of course, so for listeners that don't, you know, a lot of our listeners are pretty on point, but just to make clear, obviously NATO is a majority. There are other stipulations, but majority military joint contract, a joint agreement. And the EU is a majority political economic. What you're supposing is that the two should join.
Yeah, the EU as a political unification instrument of, like, the United States of America, the United States of Europe. That's basically what the EU is. Yeah, but of course, we need to take everybody in, and we need to have a little bit more politically. We also go into the alliance. Yeah, of course, because we only have Ireland, Malta, Cyprus, and Austria of the current EU members who are not in the NATO as well. And so there are some peripheral and historic reasons for all of the four. But, you know, to unite and to make sure that we go the next step where the union is then also part of the alliance, it makes a lot of sense. And it gives also more European responsibility. It will help the friends of NATO in the United States because it shows that Europe is taking more responsibility. And NATO will be always about European security. So the European Union should itself be inside there and also be on the table and represent all of Europe. And that's the logic in both sides. Of course, the enlargement of both institutions. Of course, the euro for all Europe who wants, but more and more countries will do that. The checks are on the, now the president has made a statement that he thinks it's time to join the euro. And I also argue, of course, that Ukraine should adopt the euro like we have done it in Kosovo and in Montenegro after the war. And so we have more unity. This is the one strategic approach. More unity of the West, the free world, more united, more cohesive, and more able to strike with the economic weight which we have. because we have about the GDP of close to half of the world, close to 50 trillion. Russia is at 1.5. Yeah. So we are really in a huge differential here, and that's very important. And the second thing, we have to end this kind of fiction that we want a united Russia as a partner. No, Russia is a hostile state. Yeah. We have to actively undermine Russian unity and work for the dividing of Russia. This must be our war game. We must be very clear. Russia as a united entity is a very dangerous construct for us, and we don't need a united Russia east of the European Union and NATO. They have attacked us. They have cost us now hundreds and billions of euros in this war and about 500,000 of people dying. So we have no reason to believe in peace with Russia. And we must actively encourage the disintegration of Russia into more and better, smaller states. That's what I call the Fellinger Doctrine. That is very important, that we basically encourage from Buratia to Chechnya, to Karelia, to Yakutia, to Tatarstan and to Bashkortostan. Many of the names, many people will not even have ever heard about it. Yeah. But as I'm part of this Free Russia for Nations forum, I also learned the names recently, to be honest, in the process of the war. And, you know, I encourage all of them to break off of Russia, and then they will, similar like in Yugoslavia, in an often complicated process, but the outcome will be much better. There will be new states east of us, and some of them will even want to join NATO and the EU in the long-term future. Some of them not, but some of them might be continuing to be hostile nuclear states, but they will be much smaller, what left over of the disintegration process of the Russian Federation. And that must be one of our principal objectives out of this. And Putin is anyhow not stopping the war. So we have to say, you know, regime change in Russia, and by the way, Iran as well, is absolutely part of our medium-term objectives. And we do what it takes to encourage this disintegration. And the next times the Chechnyans declare independence, we will support them, and the Buratians and the Karelians and others. And this is what I say. More unity on our side and actively supporting disintegration of our enemies. This is the strategy for the coming years. And that's what I'm proposing as Fellinger Doctrine to the world.
Goodness, so the Fellinger Doctrine is intense. I like it. It's strong. It's stronger than what I hear from a lot of other politicians. It's intense, and
it's not so shocking. I know you think, oh, is Fellinger insane?
It sounds shocking compared to, well, because so many, and this is something, I don't know whether you love it or hate it, it just simply is. So many, you know, as I've lived in, well, in Georgia, Eastern Europe, I've...
I ask you, did the Soviet Union break up? Did the Soviet Union break up?
Well, the Soviet...
Did the Yugoslavia break up?
Of course.
Did the Ottoman Empire break up? Did the Russian Empire break up after losing the war, and Finland, Poland, and the Baltic countries being free? Was Germany dismantled after First World War and Second World War? A significant part of Europe were Germans. They are no longer. Because why? They were losing the war.
Well, of course.
The same is true for Austria. Austria and Hungary, for example, became 10 new states after World War I. Because why? We have unfortunately started the First World War, and we lost it. And so this is a total normal process, and it will happen for Russia as well.
Well, sure, we don't, you know, we no longer have the Duchy of Salzburg and the Bohemian Kingdom, right? And you know, we don't have that anymore. And as you say, ideally, we don't have these, you know, the duchies and these small kingdoms. We have at least what ideally is a closer united Europe. Ideally,
yes, it works very well. By the way,
doesn't always work like that, but ideally. But here's the thing, and I've written about this before. I wrote a long article about this, I think a year ago, and I don't think it was for Atlas, but if Atlas wants it, I'm more than willing to republish it, because I think it's still pertinent. Okay, so we talked about a little bit, if Putin, you know, this isn't a war against necessarily Russia, this is more against the Putin state and those that follow it. If and when, whichever one you want to choose, if and when Putin is and his regime is dissolved, we can't have, you know, like, there's no way, and I'm sure you're the same way as I am, like, we can't sit in this idealized light that this is going to be some basking ray of glory. It's a vacuum of power that has to be filled. So what is the next step?
The what next step is very clear. There will be elections on the 17th of March. Yeah, Putin wants to be, I think, the sixth term the president. Yeah, he will obviously be reelected because it's more a reappointment process. But then he will have so obviously faked the elections that this is the starting point where revolution in Russia has to break up and break on. Also, there will be revolution in Russia. And then we will see what the outcome is. Will it be like a peaceful revolution? Will it be a civil war situation? Will it be a Yugoslavian scenario where some of the regions see a better future and a more prosperous future by going alone? Because many of the Asian parts of the Russian Federation today, they are very prosperous. They control a lot of resources. They could live very successfully forever alone without transferring anything towards Moscow. And so there is, of course, this case because of the huge dissatisfaction with this Ukraine war. And when Putin loses, obviously, then, of course, everybody says, you pushed us into this war and now you lose and we are in economic disaster and we have lost our export markets and we are really very badly governed. Because the same logic of all the revolutions of the last 20 years applies. The people in Russia also have good information access. Yeah? They can see exactly how the living standards are in Estonia or in Ukraine or in Japan or in other parts of the world. And they see that they are lost behind. Yeah? And mostly the Russian regions are left behind. Yeah? So absolutely, they will be ready for that. And you will see this kind of whole construct of the Russian Federation will be certainly seen very fragile. And that's, that even Chuck Sullivan knows very well. And that's why he doesn't deliver so much weapons, because he doesn't think that that's such a good idea. You know, but the Russians will do their decisions themselves. And there is a little cohesiveness in Russia today. And there's a lot of people who want to have change of regime already, because they see this whole adventure of the Ukraine war 2022 is absolutely disaster for the Russian welfare, for the Russian economy, for the military, and for so many families who lost their sons in Russia, totally useless. Yeah, because for the Russians, obviously, the Ukrainians are their best brothers, and they're seeing themselves as the same. Yeah, and now they have to die against the Ukrainians. This is a war without any legitimacy, and this delegitimizes the Russian system of Putin, and it will lose completely. And you will see big changes in this world structure of governance east of Austria, east of the European Union and NATO, and that will be very positive for the world. But the Americans have to stop to believe in Russian unity and to stop to sell out the Russian people just to make business with one guy in the Kremlin. And that's very important. And that's why I want to break this. Yes?
The Russian unity. So obviously, you know, when I grew up learning kind of geography, I think I'm pretty good at it, even with my South Pacific islands, mostly. When we look at Russia, you're right. The official title is Russian Federation, much like the United States. It's not just one big country, kind of like Germany, France, the UK, like it's not, you know, well, I guess the UK is a little bit different, but Norway, Sweden, these are all countries and they have provinces, but those provinces are not independent. You know, for example, Germany, you know, does all of its provinces are not independent from the government in Berlin. You know, same thing with France, Bretagne, Alsace-Lorraine, they are not separate from Paris. Whereas with Russia, they all have a little bit different relationship to Moscow. Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that. A reason I mentioned that is to second what you've mentioned is when you look at a demographic map of the casualties that have been taken in the fighting against Ukrainian forces for the Russian military, they are overwhelmingly in the smaller minorities in the central and east, the southern regions of Russia. If you look at St. Petersburg and Moscow, You know, there's kind of that I'm sure you're familiar, that famous phrase, you know, Moscow is not Russia. And then you insert whatever village or town you're from is Russia. Moscow is not Russia. St. Petersburg is not Russia. Sankt Petersburg nie Russia. Or my Russia is probably really broken, so somebody in the comments section can correct me. But that's basically what it is these big cities, that is not Russia. True Russia is Krasnoyarsk, Ekaterinburg, Tyumen, Omsk. Like these cities that might be big but are nowhere near the size, but they're feeding the larger war machine, because most of these young men who, let's be honest, it's not unlike the U.S. You know, I served in the U.S. military. I came from a good family, but a lot of my friends did not. It's just like the same. You know, a lot of Russian soldiers, they're not exactly coming from great families. They're coming from working families, from factories, from farms, and they don't have a lot of other prospects. And so there's sort of, at some point, when does that lever break when these small towns say, look, we can't keep giving you our working age men, we can't do it anymore.
Look, I think the moment will come in the spring. There will be the Russian spring. And it will be very astonishing for many of the American policymakers, because they think that Russia is such a wonderful entity. I don't know where they have been. Some of them might have been in hotels in Moscow and St. Petersburg and impressed by some skyscrapers. But Russia is a very underdeveloped country, and it always was, and it will be for the long term. You know, Russia is very badly regulated and very badly developed entity today. And there is many, many of the regions and the people outside of the ruling elite who are very dissatisfied. And we are insofar also fate, or the Lord is with us, that Russia has this terrible winter today. This winter, we were lucky last year, was a very soft winter in Europe. And we needed that in order that with American help, we could fill up our LNG storages. And thanks, America, for saving us last winter, by the way. And now this winter is very hard in Europe, and especially hard in Siberia and Russia. And you will see, when the moment the snow ends, the people will be on the street, and not to celebrate, but to demonstrate, because they have had this, you know, richest country of the world potentially, because Russia has all these enormous resources, and they live in a developing country in total poverty and total cold through this winter. And this will be the revolutionary kind of back burner which there will be for this spring. And Putin losing the war, losing Crimea and losing Kherson and all these areas which he will lose in the coming winter offensives of Ukraine, in which I very strongly believe that will be basically the end of the Putin regime. And he has not, can of course turn into a complete Belarusian dictatorship after March, but that will mean civil war. And this will come. And we need to prepare. And the injustice of the Russian system is huge. And this is the revolutionary toxic mix, which has often in world history led to revolutions. And it will definitely come, not only because I want it. Yeah, I definitely want that. And I want the breakup of Russia, because it's not in our strategic interest to have this hostile empire east of the NATO and the Europe. It's very dangerous, as it has proven in 2022. And they are corrupting our politicians, and they are doing all the bad things in our systems with the money they take from the regions of Russia. I want that empire to fail and to fall apart. But it is also that the people there will lead this revolution, and the various regional elites will see the opportunities, because I'm now broadcasting intensively the whole year already, together with the Free Russian of Nations Forum. It's on Twitter. You can follow it. I've made many videos, and they have made many videos, and all the people there are also, of course, seeing that the Soviet Union broke up. Why shouldn't break Russia up? And of course, Yugoslavia broke up, and also that worked. Yeah. And of course, in some areas, it will be very difficult to find the new borders. There will be regional border conflicts, as we have now even in Central Asia. This is all unfortunate, but it's not our responsibility. It's the responsibility of Putin to start this terrible war and to lose it. And he will pay the consequences by him losing the power, and Russia will also be paying the consequences by breaking up. But this is not a negative scenario, but a freedom scenario. because the new states, possible 41 states, which I have designed and argued together with this think tank, they will be much better. And in the outcome, over the next 20 years, we will have a much freer, better governed, better regulated, better management, new states east of the EU and NATO. Some might even consider to join us, and it will be much better for the people living there, because first time in history they will live under democracy, market economy, and decent rule of law, and that's of course the condition to prosper. And then suddenly everything will change in history, because the whole export of toxic propaganda and toxic influence which Russia is doing since 200 years will come to an end. And that's very positive for Western democracies as well. So we should all be united to work for victory of Ukraine, yeah, and also for the defeat of Russia.
And the Russians are extremely good at propaganda. They've had they've had decades, if not centuries, to practice, and they're extremely good at what they do. I have one quick question before we wrap up and we close everything out. So you're obviously, you know, coming from Austria, the great, the beautiful country of Austria.
Thanks.
So you were, as I understand, you're required service. So you were in the Bundeswehr.
Yes. I'm a lieutenant, but I was not in service in the last 20 years. I'm 55 years, and in Austria, everybody has to go to obligatory military. It's like a National Guard. Let's compare it better with a National Guard of one of your federal states, like of Maine. We have actually first time now a partnership with, I think it's with Maine, a National Guard, I think Maine. And this is very much similar to it. So you go there, you do your training, and then you learn how to be an officer, which I am as a second degree lieutenant. But I did some services during my studies. But when I started working, I never went again because I was living in Brussels and later Kosovo, Ukraine. Right. So I have no deep military background.
What was your specialty in the military?
Logistics.
So, okay, that's perfect. So we'll kind of do as a parting shot before we cut out for the episode, because we're a little over time. What would you say, given your experience in military logistics and obviously other experience, what would you say... I guess what is your commentary on the military objectives coming forth, both for Ukraine and for Russia? And then I don't know, what would you do if you were, I guess, Oberstleutnant in charge of all of it?
Now in the war situation, what is the recommendation you're asking me?
Yeah, I
would. You know, the military logistics are very much in favor of Ukraine, because now we have liberated the Western Black Sea and we have all the supply lines towards the European Union open and working very well between Poland and Ukraine. That works very well. Ukraine has very efficient infrastructure now to the supply. And Russia has a very big problem with supplying Crimea and, of course, with supplying this in parts they have conquered in the south. They can supply, of course, the Donbass. This is the complicated part to reconquer. But what we need to do is, of course, destroy the bridge over the Crimea, this illegal bridge, which Putin has built in 2018. So this must be completely taken out by a Taurus rocket. And this is a bunker-breaking missile, or by an Atamak or whatever. And the bridge must go. And then, of course, the railway and highway lines towards Crimea must be conquered. And then you need to push the Ukrainian forces in a very big push over the Dnipro once it's frozen. Now, very soon, you need to cross the Dnipro when it's frozen, bring also armored vehicles over and artillery, and then push the Russian forces back in the occupied Donbass. And this has to happen. Then Crimea must be liberated together, of course, with a rising of the Crimean people to also take back power for themselves from the Russian occupation authorities. And this must be simultaneously happening in the next 2 months. And then we have, of course, to supply the air force and the missiles and the tanks, which are necessary for the Ukrainians to do that. But I'm confident this is happening already. And so we will have a very big success in the coming 2 months. And then once this is achieved, of course, we are basically at the stalemate of the old disengagement line from 2021. And there it will be very hard to push further into the occupied Donbass. I think that's a military achievement, which is very complicated. And it will only happen after the fall of Putin, when the moment the Russian forces will withdraw from Donbass, because then when Putin falls, they will go back into their barracks back home in Russia. And so this will be maybe also only in the summer possible. But this is the optimum scenario, and I think it's a realistic scenario. And logistically, the Russians are at the end of the measures, and most of the tanks are destroyed already, and they are fighting with very old equipment, and their morale is low, their financial stamina is running out. So I don't see any reasons why we shouldn't win very convincingly in the coming weeks, and that will also lead to the political changes. But, you know, our Jack Sullivans of this West, maybe they have a bit different agenda to keep Putin in power because he's great to make business. I think it would be very unfortunately to somehow save Putin as a kind of guarantee of Russian unity. And because he's such a cool guy, really, who can think that way is for me a deeply immoral politician and also very negative because you know, who really needs Putin in power? He has brought only misery to the world, and the world without Putin is a much better world.
Ausgezeichneter Plan. Leutnant Fellinger, vielen Dank.
Let's meet in 2 months, and let's hope for freedom of Crimea.
Hopefully so. Owl Wars, you got Thanks, anything dude. Before we think? I think we're meeting up on time, and I think that's it.
Yeah, I think we're all good. Thank you, Gunther, so much for joining us. Appreciate having us on to talk and having a nice long conversation this Friday morning or evening for you and night for Mike.
For our listeners, thank you so much for listening. Gunther, it was a pleasure and genuine honor to have you on board. Yeah, by all means, we'll probably have to do another checkup in a few months, maybe, I don't know, somewhere in summer. We'll see how things go, because at this point, everything is changing too quick. By all means, everything we're talking about could be completely outdated by the end of this podcast. But if you're not already subscribed, subscribe to Atlas Plus. Other than that, ladies and gentlemen, have a great evening. We'll talk to you later.